Hey, good morning. We're about to start our last discussion of this month, and we're going to discuss goodwill and impairment. I give the floor to Raghav.
Good morning, Jan. So we have five agenda papers for today's meeting, but the focus of today's discussion would be on agenda paper 18B. Now, the cover paper sets out the objective for today and introduces the other four papers as well. Now, agenda paper 18A explains the objectives and scope of the Goodwill and Impairment Research Project and also summarizes the board's discussions to date. I draw your attention to paragraph 5 of agenda paper 18A that explains the reasons why we are not currently focusing on alternative models of accounting for goodwill. So consequently, your comments would be most helpful in our research if you focus more on the possible approaches to simplifying impairment test and making it more effective rather than the alternative models of accounting for goodwill as of now. Now, I'll come to agenda paper 18B at the end. Agenda paper 18C summarizes the pre-acquisition headroom approach and provides an update on our research of other approaches similar to the pre-acquisition headroom approach. Agenda paper 18D explains possible improvements to the disclosure requirements about goodwill and impairment, which the board discussed in its past meetings. We updated the analysis to reflect our recommendations and your comments. Now, agenda paper 18B. Coming back to agenda paper 18B, it sets out the possible approaches that could be considered in simplifying the impairment test without making it less robust. The analysis in the paper mainly focuses on using a single basis for determining recoverable amount and providing relief from the requirement to perform an annual impairment test. Now, although our research on the single basis for determining recoverable amount started as a cost-cutting measure, we think that moving to a single model will probably help in improving the effectiveness of the test as explained in paragraph 14 of the paper. Now, the analysis of the single model is set out in paragraphs 9 through 28 of the paper, and the analysis of relief from annual test is set out in paragraphs 29 to 39 of the paper. So with that, I open the meeting for your comments and discussion.
Martin. I think regarding this analysis so far, what we have done and what you have also mentioned in paragraph 16, what the following, regarding the, I think the relief is to have only one model to calculate the impairment. I think we should not pursue it any longer because I think the arguments given in paragraph 16 are still valid, that okay, we need a company before having an impairment have two choices. They can still have this kind of CTU as a kind of operations, and if it is not the value maybe is impaired, they can also think about selling this entity, and therefore the value, the fair value is also, I think, a valid measure to account for impairment because they have opportunities to sell or not to sell. And I think also the relief is not so big as you said, because in most of the cases it is a kind of TCF model and which companies are using. So the cost relief, I think, is not very big, and therefore I think we should stay what we have. We have two alternatives, value and use, and then okay, the fair value, because I think the arguments, as I said, are still valid. Because the IASC has said, okay, so the company has two opportunities to keep the entity and to sell it, and therefore I think both models are still valid and the cost relief is not there. And therefore I think we should not further pursue this kind of opportunity. And also I think in the post-limitation review there was not a strong argument that we should get rid of these two values.
Tak. Thank you. I'm in the same line with Martin's argument. Actually, changing the measurement method to just single one would go beyond just the simplification, because I think that is the, you know, fundamental concept of IS 36. So if we simply say we are going to make it a single measurement, that is not just a simple tweak of the IS-36. It's a fundamental conceptual change, and it would cause some other consequence to other impairment and the measurement concept. So it's going to be a big change. And then, considering the big change, what is the outcome? So I have completely agree with what the Martin is talking about. If I look back to my background, and when we consider impairment, preparer has their own future pictures. So no matter how the measurement method is all about, they have, in a sense, kind of stubborn idea what is going to happen. And then it depends all upon just the paperwork in real life. Yeah. So therefore, actually, you know, that is too much to say. But in real life, it's really something like that. So therefore, even if we make it a single method, it would reduce a slight amount of paperwork, but it wouldn't really, significant improvement for the preparers. So considering pros advantage and disadvantage, I don't think it's a good idea to introduce a single method. Stephen?
So I don't agree. I think we should change, and I think we should have a single method, and I think just fair value would be simpler for everybody concerned. The problem's always in this value in use calculation, so the discount rates, the taxation effects, that we have those restrictions. When the IASC did all of this, we didn't have IFRS 13 in place, and I think that makes a difference. As Martin said, it's quite similar, the same discounted cash flow type approach, and it seems very odd to me to have these slight variations, and I don't really see that there's any good that comes from having the higher of. No, I would just do fair value.
If it saves some paperwork, it may not be a big improvement, but at least it is a bit of an improvement.
And it would also help convergence.
A little bit along Stephen's lines, I think, but I wanted to ask you a question about, so I'm trying to read between the lines a little bit, and I wonder whether some people are suggesting the removal of the two methods for cost-related reasons, and subject to the comments that Tack and Martin had made about whether there's really much cost relief, but that would be one reason to simplify the test. But is there a sense, maybe from some, that the value and use calculation is a softer calculation, and so maybe it's tied into the timeliness of the recognition of impairment?
I think it's more about, I think one of our observations is that the higher of the two models gives some chance for entities to play around the recoverable amount calculation. So it like it gives them a leverage to move between methods to see which one is higher or pick a method which is higher. So there could be a chance for delaying the recognition of impairment or even manipulating the amount of impairment loss that gets recognized. So that's a reason even in my TF I sort of said, although we started off looking at a single model as a cost relief measure, but I do agree with Martin's comment also that there's not much of a cost relief in that, because IAS 36 doesn't require an entity to determine both amounts every year. So if one of the amounts gives them comfort that there's no impairment, they need not determine the other amount. But what we observed is probably the softer way of calculating VIU gives a bit of a leverage in probably delaying the recognition of impairment loss or the amount of impairment loss. So that's become our main focus for looking at the single model.
And Tuck just confirmed that he actively used that in his past, right?
Sure, in the spirit of the standard. Let's not. But I guess that might mean that we'd still think about it, but with a slightly different perspective in terms of what we're achieving, so it just changed the way we'd be thinking about the analysis. I don't know whether there's truth or not in that value and use, allegation. But it's just a different way of thinking about it.
Gary.
Thank you. And, I agree, but only to a point, with Martin Tuck. I mean, I think getting rid of one model or the other might save a little bit of work, but doesn't save you a whole lot. It, I sort of actually have a, I would probably leave both models there, but if you're going to hold and use in operations, I would say you should use a value and use model. If you're going to dispose, I think value less cost disposal model makes sense. So I don't know that they're mutually exclusive. I think they're situational depending on your intention. Now, acknowledging, you know, fair value and Stephen's arguments is, it's hard and difficult to get objective evidence of what a market participant thinks of an acquisition's value. You know, you might, particularly after, it's one thing when you're in a bidding war and you buy it, you know, on day one and the other bids are out on the table, but, you know, starting day two, day three, day four, I mean, that gets old information quickly. The company or the acquisition you buy, it's worth it to you for the reasons that it's important to you. And I think when we get to 18D on disclosures, we can deal with some of that. So the value and use calculation to a large measure, I think, comes to internal long-term budgeting is where most of the inputs come from. So I think, you know, they're no more or less objective or subjective than, you know, level three fair value information that you might develop, but they are, but they are yours, you know, and you can also have a look back, how did you do against what I tell you next year, a year later, you can look back and see how good was your forecasting. The other thing, we're not talking here, but paragraph 7A talks about some more minor changes about removing restrictions on cash flows. I think at some point in time, I assume we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
And the last part, being less specific about whether you use pre- or post-tax inputs, I guess we're going to debate what is the better input, but being less specific about it, I don't think is the way we should go about that. I assume later on we'll get to different manual testing models and some comments to later on that.
Tom?
Yeah, first a question for Stephen. You said fair value, just fair value, no cost of sale.
I would do that, yes.
Okay. So, and then the other, I guess my other is, it was interesting that Stephen agreed with Martin and came to the opposite conclusion, that the costs are not huge between the two. And I guess that that's an important consideration about what are we really trying to do with the two. And so I was just looking at the fair value standard, and it seems to me they're going to converge, especially if you do, if you take away the cost of disposal, they're going to converge quite closely in the paragraph 29, where it says an entity's, this is the fair value standard, it says an entity's current use of a non-financial asset is presumed to be its highest and best use unless market or other factors. I would think an entity might have a hard time, especially if we make some disclosure changes, arguing that there were some market factors that would elevate this price a lot. So I'm not sure if there's that much room to maneuver if you leave the choices, and so there might be some simplification, but if you then go to fair value, you make it, I think if you do have, if they do come to the same thing, then most of the time it's going to be value and use if you tack on some cost of disposal to the other one. So it might be simpler and clearer to go to one thing, but it kind of depends a little bit on what we're aiming at. And also it goes to a little bit, not just simplification, but effectiveness, and the two start to really overlap. I'm not sure what the answer is, but I totally agree that I don't think the cost between the two are high. I especially think if you read paragraph 29, it's going to be hard to actually get something radically different. So then I like simplification, and I think lowering the cost of doing impairment testing would be a good thing.
Ms. Maza.
I would be in favor of simplifying. It may not be a huge cost, but it's still cumbersome. to document and review and see what difference there are. And in fact, I would go for having the basis match the expectations of the entity. So if there is no disposal plan, I would go for the value in use. I would also wish to be in the situation that Gary described, being able to use my own estimates. And as a result, I would want to have the possibility of the capital expenditures, development costs, restructuring be taken into account, which the staff notes in the paper would bring, in fact, the value closer to what the level 3 fair value would be. So, and I would do that because I think for that first reason, I mean, at least you use your own estimate. So I think that is a real simplification because you're using your data. They exist. They're validated by an internal control system through governance of the entity, so they have that strength. And also because, in fact, when I link that to the other proposals that you're developing, you're very much focusing on how the entity will benefit from the acquisition, how it's going to report, and how it performs. And it's going to report on how it performs in the way it implements its plan and not on a different possible assumption. I would also highlight that in the preparation of the post-implementation review of IFRS 13, the issue of the highest and best use has been identified as an issue in practice. So that would be raised in this instance if we were moving to the fair value model.
I fully support what Martin, Tucker, Gary expressed. I think the key problems from beginning, I like what Martin emphasized again and again, what is the number one real problem we are now facing? In my view, the real problem is the manipulation and enforceability. And the people just not use the standards properly as we intended. And from beginning, and we always try to emphasize what we got from the feedback is the model is conceptually, you know, sound. I question, you know, whether it is truly conceptually sound. And we explore the, for example, the headrooms and others. These kind of investigation shows it is hard to draw a line between the goodwill you bought and the goodwill you later generated. And if you trace back the history, you know, Professor Steve Zaff wrote many articles on this, and his view is very simple. You know
who?
Steve Zaff.
The current requirement is actually a result of political compromise. That is, you know, the high-tech companies supported by hedge fund, by merchant banks, at the beginning won't keep pooling of interest. And they fell, and then they reach some kind of compromise, you know, the delete or eliminate amortization. Then they can manipulate as much as they want. And we had statistical educational sessions and shows. I'm not sure whether the statistics are accurate. And one of the conclusion is, you know, the particular for the some of the high-tech American companies, if they want to amortize based on the Japanese model, and they will use more than 100 years to amortize them. And recently, in China, a few scholars, together with Shanghai Stock Exchange's senior manager, also published a paper on this. If staff interested in, you know, I can give it to you, but in Chinese, you know, but I can explain to you the key ideas. So we have to think about, you know, the logic. That is whether we truly believe your conceptually current requirements is sound. If
not, then we should find a shortcut rather than spend effort like this.
Jiang Wu.
Thank you. I agree with Steve's idea. We should go to a single model. But the reasons are, I think, is the more effective impairment test. And also, as Tak said, this is a really big change if we go to a single model. The reason why I'm saying is almost all the preparers are now using VIU. So if we assume this single method is going to use that is going to use a fair value, then all preparers in this maybe European countries and Asian countries, almost all of them must change from the VIU method to the fair value or fair value LCP method. So this is a really big change. So if we just go to the VIU method as one single method, we shouldn't do anything. Because in reality, all preparers are using VIU, so we don't have to amend our method. So the valid assumption, if we go to the single method, we should go to the fair value kind of a model. In otherwise, there's no good effectiveness in impairment testing. So as Steve said, this is more consistent with the US GAAP. Also, many investors would like to have this kind of a more the proper impairment test and such kind of information investors would like to have. And also, just a few preparers are suggesting VIU method is just kind of very arbitrary. And even this kind of small number of preparers, we should have a kind of fair value method for this kind of impairment testing. Also, maybe if we cannot have a kind of a single method, just allowing the fair value method, if there's a too big impact to all preparers, then we should go to the more narrow scope of this single method. Just for example, non-amortized assets only, goodwill or indefinite life intangible assets. These two assets are very critical because they are not amortized at all. So if you just allow them, they're prepared to choose one of these two methods, VIU and the fair value, then it's really the final numbers on the balance sheet or income statement may be not so useful, especially for investors. So if you see this kind of all the current situation in the market by preparers, by investors, or some regulators, even auditors, they have their own views on this thing. I guess it's not easy, however, because of this impact, big impact to preparers. But we need to go to that direction. As FASB did a very good job in eliminating the second impairment test, it's a very complex. However, what I'm thinking is to improve what the impairment test or to prevent too late problem, we absolutely need some kind of measure on this issue.
Daryl?
So picking up on a couple of strands here, I think I would agree, particularly given the discussion we've just had with the comment that Sue made, that I think it's imperative we understand why we think we want to make this change. We started out by talking about things like cost relief and simplification. I would go further than both Martin and Tuck in that. I don't think there's significant costs in having the two tests because of the fact that you only test one and the second test is only triggered if the first one has failed. But I'd go a little bit further and say I think this a single model would actually introduce costs. I think it introduces costs for a little bit of the reason that Chung Wu is talking about, that what companies do right now is they choose the least cost approach. And I suspect the reason, to Cheng Wu's point, that most companies have gone down the value in use approach is because they have that information at hand. That's essentially looking at their expected forecasts of results and et cetera, and using that as a starting point. Now, I agree with some of the comments that others have made that what we would see is a level three approach converging towards a value in use approach. I think that's right. But I do think that the fair value approach or the level three fair value approach puts an additional test on you. And that additional test is, what does an external party or how does an external party do? I think that additional test is a costly test. I think it introduces a lot of additional costs for people to think about. But that doesn't mean I support removing the fair value approach, because I think there are going to be circumstances where fair value makes more sense. If the underlying entity is listed, for example, then the fair value of that underlying entity may be more available, more applicable in those specific circumstances. So I would say that probably supporting where I think three or four of us have landed, I would keep the two tests. I would keep the idea that you test one, whichever you believe is appropriate given costs and other considerations. You trigger the other one in the event that the first one fails, to make sure. I don't think triggering the second test is something that we need to worry too much about. I think most entities would want to do the second test if they failed the first one, because simply because it makes sense to consider, if I'm testing VIU, to test fair value if I fail the VIU approach.
A couple of thoughts which I would like to add. And I think on this point about level three fair value converging with value in use, one aspect of that we are trying to explore is, would VIU be greater than a level three fair value or lesser than a level three fair value? And our initial reactions are that because of the restrictions which IAS 36 imposes on the cash flows to be considered in a VIU calculation, I think intuitively we would think that if both level three fair value and VIU were determined on a discounted cash flow model, VIU has to be lower than a level three fair valuation. We are still exploring that thought. And then when we think about situations of companies that have recognized impairment losses, and that impairment loss is based on VIU, there's an inherent tension there because we would expect them to measure both fair value and VIU, see which one is higher, and based on that recognize an impairment loss. But a few companies that we have seen, they say we've determined good impairment loss or the recoverable amount based on higher of the two, but then they finally end up using VIU. So there's that confusion in our mind which we are trying to research. So, I mean, we are looking at financial statements of companies, especially for those years in which they have recognized an impairment loss, and see what method they've used in measuring the recoverable amount. I mean, intuitively, we would expect fair value to be used because fair value should actually give a better result than VIU, at least in those years in which impairment losses are recognized. So that's something which we are focusing on.
I think just to add one extra point that I think which is important, which is that, which I forgot to mention earlier, and I think this comes back to Sue's original question. I do think if we are changing the reason for why we're doing this, and the reason is that we think it's a more effective test from the outside, I think that's a different rationale. But we're presenting this at the moment as a simplification cost type.
Yeah.
Can I just ask follow up? Sorry, guys. Just directly responding to something you just said, Raghava. So if what you said was true, and I'm not saying it's not, but if the VIU is more constrained in terms of the cash flows you can take into account, so you think that should mean it generally be equal to or less than, does that mean that you disagree with the suggestion, or it shouldn't be the case that it could be that preparers could bring in more optimistic cash flow forecasts and then get a more favourable result? So you're suggesting that shouldn't be possible reading the words in the standard?
Yeah. Because IAS 36, I mean, look, even sticking to IAC's considerations, they explain that they would expect an entity to maximize external inputs rather than management's best estimates. So, which means, how can VIU be higher than fair value at any time?
I mean, can I add an additional point? Is that I think you've said it in terms of talking about the convergence thing. I think, and we can argue about whether or how robust the verification can ever be about determining fair the future cash flows of what might well be unique assets. So putting that aside for the moment, I think that basic testing process is identical for VIU and for level 3. You're going to have to go through the same process of trying to determine what you think the drivers are, with the additional add-on then in the fair value of considering what an external party would come to. Now, I think it's possible. I think it's doable. I think most companies are doing this as part of their own internal evaluation of what they want to do or not. But I think that both processes are subject to precisely the same questions that would be raised.
So it's level 3.
And even coming to the other point about removing the restrictions in IAS 36, I mean, that's the feedback we've got in IAS 36, that why would you constrain consideration of capital expenditure or restructuring? But once you remove those restrictions, then VIU is really moving very close to level 3 fair value in my mind. I mean, we're still doing a research on that. Then what are the two models there? I mean, then what's the role of a VIU there? Would it allow managements to manipulate the impairment test?
I don't think it allows for manipulation. I think what it does is it provides relief in not requiring you to go out and consider what an external party would, how an external party would do that. So what it does is it removes a step of having to go through the process and prove you've done that. And given what we're saying here, prove that you've done it every period.
Mary?
I came in without strong views about the, you know, eliminate one test or the other. And during the discussion, my concern level has been ratcheting up about whether we are conscious of the size of the box of issues we're opening. The development of IAS 36 was, I think, one of the hardest things the ISC dealt with, really on a par with the developing IS 39, and there are a tremendous number of interlocking decisions, and we're now, I think, reversing into a reconsideration of the basic impairment model and what its objectives are on the back of a PIR of the business combination standard, and I think we may be fooling ourselves to think that we can, that we have enough information to go in and make fundamental decisions about fundamental aspects of IS 36, which apply to many impairment tests, many of which do involve goodwill and indefinite lived intangibles, but the same test also applies to other non-financial instruments. Now, in terms of one test, you know, one benchmark versus two, in terms of the, is the carrying value impaired? First, let's remember that IFRS has, at the root of its impairment approach for non-financial items, the concept that you write off what is not recoverable, not, and, you know, and it does not have a reset to fair value when you have an impairment trigger, and that's a pretty fundamental conceptual anchor of IS 36. Now, if we went to a, if you have an impairment trigger, reset to fair value, and that's what I think in effect would happen, whether you said only fair value less cost to dispose, or fair value, you know, or just fair value, that would be a pretty fundamental conceptual change in terms of what the objective of our impairment model is. Now, our impairment model is, in some ways, half pregnant in that it says, you know, it, because you reverse impairments if circumstances change, except for goodwill impairments. So that's why I say half pregnant. You know, it's got this only the non recoverable portion. So I think, you know, my first message is, if we think that we want to make changes that even if they appear limited are significant conceptually to our impairment model, let's step back and make a decision about what we, you know, whether we want to take on a reconsideration of the impairment model or not. Because if I think we reverse into it and then keep expanding and expanding, we'll not only frame the project ineffectively and we won't have sufficient evidence, but we may find something that takes a whole lot longer and doesn't have the right basis for consultation. So That's a big caution about it. I think if we looked at it and said, I understand that from our perspective, from a preparer's perspective, it's complicated to explain in the area of impairment, well, you know, you have to test, and then there are two routes, and we've chosen, you know, we've identified this basis, fair value less cost to dispose, or value in use as the basis for calculating impairment. What's the difference? What would it have been if you'd used the other one? You know, having two approaches adds generic layer of complexity. I share the concerns expressed by several people here about whether, from a calculation perspective, there's as much complexity from having two approaches as we might think. I think if we were to look at it in terms of saying, is there a simplification that we should be looking for with a lot of caution about, is this reopening IS-36, in some ways it comes back to what's noted in paragraph 20B of this paper, which was the ISC's conclusion that if fair value less cost to dispose is higher than value in use, the inherent loss, if the entity intends to continue to use it, you know, kind of on the value in use basis, should be recognized in the periods in which it has suboptimal use, rather than up front. So I think we could look at, if we were to look at eliminating something, I think we should look at eliminating the fair value less cost to dispose alternative. Not because I think that information is less relevant, and therefore I don't like advocating that. But when I look at the logic that the ISC set out, when you start with the objective being what is the portion that is not recoverable, and if the entity intends to continue to use it in a suboptimal basis, value in use reflects what they expect to get from that, and so therefore what portion of the carrying value is not recoverable. That seems more consistent, and I think that 20B conclusion is the one that is perhaps conceptually a bit suspect. But my bigger caution is, let's think about whether we really want to go down the path of reworking IS-36, and would we end up with IS-36A, which you use when you're doing good, you know, CGUs that include goodwill and indefinite lives intangibles, and IS-36 basic for, you know, for other circumstances. And if we're going to look at IS-36, let's stop, get a project plan that is looking at IS-36. Now, having said that, do I think the staff is on the right, is doing the right thing in terms of saying, should we look to see whether there are any simplifications that could be pursued, because that's putting pressure on the subsequent accounting for goodwill? Yes, but I think I would just say go back and look at the packages and the different avenues you're pursuing and recognize what might be in reality a masked reconsideration of the impairment model. So caution, and I'm afraid not very specific suggestions about follow up this point or that point.
I think I do agree with you that initially we were, at least I was afraid whether we are like reopening the whole of IAS-36 model by considering a single model. But I think the only question I have in my mind is fair value measurement neutral to a decision to continue to use the asset or sell it? And I mean, because that's the basis in IAS-36, that if an asset is an impaired, an entity, a rational entity, would either decide to continue to use it or sell it immediately. Now, for one reason, I probably agree with Steve's comment that he would retain fair value, because it's the costs of disposal which makes the measurement linked to the decision to sell an asset. But if we remove that cost of disposal, which is more a characteristic of the transaction rather than the asset, and if it's just a fair value measurement, is that neutral to an entity's decision to continue to use or sell? I mean, does fair value really reflect, is a fair value measurement only a relevant measurement if an entity decides to sell the asset, or is it fine even if an entity decides to continue to use it?
I think maybe working through that a bit more would be useful, but two cautions. One is, for the same reasons that there is unlikely to be observable market values for the package, the CGU of items, I think it's unrealistic to say an entity that has this, if it has a higher fair value, would just turn around and sell it immediately, because many of these things can't just be sold immediately. That, you know, that's one. And the other is, let's remember to put the standard in this calculation on a spectrum. We also have a standard IFRS 5 that says when you reach X point, with, you know, you have to measure the package of items on a fair value basis, because you have an intent and a plan that you expect to dispose of within a year. Well, are we kind of creating a gray zone of you're entering or approaching IFRS 5, and are we doing it if you don't necessarily have the intent of going that way? Just stand back and put them put in the IFRS 5 piece.
But at that stage, when an entity decides to sell the assets, wouldn't VIU and fair value be very close to each other? Because the only thing remaining in terms of VIU is recovering the amount by selling the assets. So there wouldn't be a difference between.
And I'm not so worried about the difference. What I'm getting to is, if we drew the line for when you go to the IFRS 5 model here, in terms of intent plus expectation, that you can complete it within basically a year, then why would we sneak up on the shift to that measurement basis when we fall short of the trigger?
Amaru.
Thanks, Ms. First reaction when I read this, the whole session, was, well, I don't like options, and I think dual requirements can be costly and disruptive in terms of consistent application and comparison, and achieving comparison. So when reading this, I was thinking about, well, we should naturally go to one model only, because this is the best way. Then I haven't decided which model. So read again and I said, well, if I'm thinking about the use of the non-financial asset, value in use, as Mary mentioned in her conclusion, would be my natural response to that. But then reading the paper and reaching, following your reasoning, that actually the both values would be quite similar, and we end up with naturally, because of the nature of these items in level 3, I said, well, actually, they are very similar, so why you do have two? So then, you mentioned in paragraph 7 that in the future meetings, you intend to bring easing value use calculation and providing additional guidance in applying IAS 36. And I said, well, this appears to me that staff is opening the door to, if they're envisaging one model, this model would be value in use. Because if they intend to bring in the future, they're not considering the possibility of having only fair value. Or they are in doubt about enough elements to convince us that we should go to one model. And then I was back in doubt as well. And you made a comment that staff is still assessing the real difference between the two models. So that brought me back to the two models, because if it's a matter of cost, apparently we are not convinced that is real significant reduction in cost, since one is required, is triggered only if necessary. We also apparently agreed that the two models wouldn't add too much cost to reach. So I honestly think, considering all that was said about fundamental aspect of IS 36 in terms of impairment tests, and what you already said to me or to us in terms of still really not totally convinced that you have all the elements to reach a conclusion between the difference of the two. I believe the only way for me to comment on this is that we should keep at this stage the two requirements, because of all that was said about the costs, the effectiveness, and although my preference would be one only, one model only, I think I would like to wait for you to bring us the elements that you are searching to have a clear position on the benefits of having only one. And I come back to paragraph 7 on your paper, and I think you are still in the middle of the road to bring us there. I don't honestly think we have enough elements to go to either fair value, that would be my preference in terms of consistent and effective in applying our literature, or value in use, that would be my preference if I still believe it's the best number to reflect the expectation of the entity in using the asset. That would naturally be the right answer. So I think the only way for me to comment on this, you are not asking for votes, I guess, you are just asking for comments. My comment is, I don't think you have enough yet to suggest one model only.
Okay, Martin.
Yeah, I wanted also to add, man, if we would, like Stephen has said, only go to fair value, I think we have to solve also this P times Q problem which we have for the whole investments, because only want to remind you about that, because man, I think it will be even more, it would be even more relevant, because I think we have concluded maybe that the kind of transactions are very rare now, but if we go only to fair value, I think we will not have only rare transactions, because I think there are many transactions where a company acquired a listed company and then maybe restructuring this company only several years after that, so they have to then to do the goodwill impairment test on the still listed companies, but then in this kind of situation there are only a lot of, very often only minority interests outstanding, so a few number of shares listed and the majority is still acquired. And therefore, I think really then the problem which we're facing with this kind of question, is P times Q adequate or do we should have a control premium, would increase. And the reaction which we get from, I think, respondents on our P times Q question was really they are not very happy with it. But if we go only fair value, I think we will face a big, big problem. And I kind of, my experience is my many companies pay control premiums, but if we then have to do the goodwill impairment test immediately after that by P times Q, then they have to impair it immediately. I don't know if we get a lot of applause from users, but also not from preparers. Therefore, I think we should, if we go only fair value, we should consider that very carefully.
I give the floor to Stephen for a rebuttal.
So I think it would be a challenge rather than a problem, but
what is the difference?
Going back to Mary's comment about an IS 36 project plan, I think we've done it already. I mean, we've got the agenda consultation, we've been told that there are issues with the impairment test, so to my mind we don't need any further consultation. We're in it and we need to think about where we're going. This whole area for me is an issue of trust and trust in the numbers. We have trust in our mission statement. I think this is about trust, because I don't think the investors trust the value in use numbers. Now, I agree that for a level 3 fair value measure, many of the same problems arise. But you've got the anchor to the market participant, an anchor to the market. And it's not just when there's a market price available, but it's also where there is other market data, which effectively you can largely ignore in a value in use. I know people are saying that if you remove the restrictions on value in use, they converge. I'm not convinced that's the case. Darrell mentioned about expected forecaster results. You can base your value in use calculation on your expected internal forecaster results. Somebody else mentioned the word budget. Companies budget for success. Therefore, the value in use measure tends to reflect an expectation of success. The market isn't perfect, but the market's more realistic. It knows that there is a chance of success, there's a chance of failure. Market prices reflect that. I just think that if you want to improve trust in financial reporting, we should get rid of the value in use calculation. I know that there would be challenges in moving to fair value. I know it wouldn't be popular, but I think it would put more power in the hands of the auditors and the regulators to challenge the numbers which are presented by companies.
But so then it would not be about cost relief, it would really be about
effectiveness.
Improving the quality of the test.
Cost relief is fine, I'm happy for that, but really I think it would provide better information.
It would probably not be a cost relief.
No. I mean, think of another area in reporting, IFRS 9. We spend a lot of time talking about the measurement of long-term investments, particularly equity investments. IFRS 9 requires fair value. We could have had value in use in IFRS 9 for equity investments. There are some people that lobbied us to do so, the long-term investing group that have lobbied for that greater sort of management view of the value of these long-term equity investments. We've always rejected that, I think partly because of the issue of trust. I think it's a much more relevant measure to have fair value, and I think it applies just as much in this situation as it does to those equity investments.
Can I ask Steve a quick question? When you talk about that, and it comes back a little bit to Mary's point, are you talking about then removing value in use not just for goodwill but more broadly?
Well, that's another question, and I don't want to expand the scope of this project on the fly, but...
But
can I also ask a question, man? If you don't use a budget for the cash flows, man, where do you get from market?
Views
of future cash flows from a CTU, man.
No, of course it's going to be internal.
Exactly, and there's no better source.
for the auditor to challenge the internal numbers. It's very difficult when it's value in use. If management says, we're going to grow this by 5%, we're going to earn margins of X, how are the auditors going to challenge that? If they can point to external market data, valuation multiples, whatever for other entities, it's much easier to challenge those assumptions which have been made by management. I mean, in theory, I agree that if you remove the restrictions on value in use, the two measures should converge. But in practice, I don't think that's the case.
Gary?
And Raghav, just a handful of miscellaneous thoughts. And so far I think in this project, for the most part, we're looking at the limitations of the impairment test from a sort of bottoms up, looking at individual elements of it. And I think at some point, since we're struggling with it, the world is struggling with it, where do we start looking at from a tops down, like sort of, if not a clean sheet approach, but something different? I mean, in paper 18C, we talked about the performance headroom approach, which I'm not a particular fan of, but it is new thinking. Is there other things we can consider? I mean, for example, at what point, even if it arguably is still a CGU, might it be more appropriate to consider the company's cash flows as a whole? It just might stand alone, but it picks up the company's name, it picks up its distribution capabilities, and so on, and therefore it's part of the company as opposed to its own CGU. And I'm not saying we should definitely pursue that route, but I'm using that as an example of maybe we need just a brand new approach to some of this stuff. I would also make a point in kind of going up to the relief from annual testing section, but I'll start with, we'll talk more perhaps in paper 18D about disclosing how'd you do against key targets. The fact that you might miss some key targets doesn't necessarily mean you're not operating profitably. You just might not be operating quite as profitably as you might like. And so that doesn't necessarily mean you have an impairment or a loss situation. So KPIs and key targets have got their use, but I wouldn't necessarily put all the votes in that lane. Plus, key performance targets, you know, are often expressed as ranges, and they might not necessarily be expressed in ways that are conducive to doing this test. You know, we'll be, could be, we expect to be neutral cash flow wise the first 3 years, incremental to profitability starting year four. I mean, those are pretty broad sweeping numbers, and you know, may or may not be useful, you know, for purposes of applying any of the impairment tests we're looking at. I do think on relief from annual testing, I think there's two pieces to it. Which is one thing that always bothers me. If you buy an acquisition the last working day of a year, you got to do an impairment test for that year end close. When you just went through a negotiation process, maybe it's a bid, maybe so on. So, I mean, something an impairment test shortly after the period after you've heavily negotiated it might be one type of relief and buys you a year or two. So you assume it's at fair value, that management is prudent and executing its stewardship reasonably, and it's not fully operational for a while anyway. So that's one piece of annual testing, but that would say after a year or two or something, then at some point you got to go on to more of the traditional methods. But as I read paragraph 36, it says the staff envisioned this indicator would only operate for the first few years, say 3 years, which I actually don't agree with that. But does the inference on that is then you go to the more detailed fair value or value and use test. So the relief from annual testing is a temporary relief. It's not a permanent relief. Just one. That's what I thought, where I thought you were. I'm not. And again, you're back to then. What sort of indicators perhaps could make it a more longer-term relief? And again, thinking maybe we just need to step back and get out of the mechanics and think a little bit more broadly about it. Thank you.
We should be rounding up this discussion. See some short comments emerging.
Only one. And I think if, as Steve said, man, if the fair value will solve the problems that people will not trust in the test and make it more effective. And I think we should then go to the US and look, have a look if, because they have the fair value, if they don't have the same concerns as we have, which I would doubt, but I would ask the staff maybe do some research in the US if the fair value have solved the problems that now, okay, the effectiveness of this test is now good and people trust in this test. I would doubt that.
Yeah, perhaps talk to some auditors.
Yeah.
It does indeed give them an extra instrument to show their professional skepticism. Guo?
Steve, you know, we enter into roughly the same time, we will retire roughly at the same time. I personally feel you are too idealistic. You know, what you say is very similar to what James said about 10 years ago about why you not use full fair value for financial instruments. You know, it's so simple.
And he was a
so
great easy. Man.
Yeah. Add two evidence to you. When we develop, you know, the 9, and we decide to use fair value for equity method, equity investment, and once we read a book by somewhere and about the private equity investment valuation committee or like this, they list 13 different kind of method to fair value the equity investment. Keep in mind. And secondly, recently I had lots of discussion in China with the preparers. You know, in the past, you know, the maybe because of pressure from the Chinese Ministry of Finance, company are forced to all induced to use OCR category. And now we move to pure 9, and I asked them whether you will use the Japanese, you know, OCI type of things. They say, we will not use it. Then I said, whether you worry about fluctuation into your PMA. And they say, we don't worry, because there are 13 or more than methods. Certain method you can fair value the equity investment. So what I want to say is, it will not be too idealistic.
Okay.
Well, just a quick word, because I understand we don't have much time, but I wanted
also to point out that in paragraph 23, and also, I mean, reflecting I-36, the staff here has identified that I-36 calls for having estimates reflecting market evidence. So if it is not the case today, maybe this should be better enforced. But I'm not sure that calling for fair value will change that. In substance, just because it would be called fair value, people would enforce better having estimates reflecting market assumptions. But what that would do would, I think, significantly increase the cost of the estimates, because you would have to consider hypothetical assumptions that would not necessarily be supported by evidence. You would have to question what is the level of synergies that this CGU in this business benefits from that should be removed. So I think you would, and without having much market evidence in order to do so, so I think it would be more complex, eventually less relevant, and not reach the efficiency level that you would expect.
Doc, yes. Can I talk about annual impairment test now or after your explanation?
No, that's fine.
No, okay. Okay, so with respect to removing annual impairment test and just indicator only approach, I think as it is written in paragraph 36, we introduced this method because we are not going to do the amortization. So therefore, we think we have quite a high hurdle to move to this, to remove this annual impairment test without reintroducing amortization, because you know if we did it, it's kind of I don't think there is a enough legitimacy to do that without reintroducing amortizing goodwill, and also the introducing indicator only approach may increase the subjectivity, because although the there is a kind of indicator, but the indicator is much easier than the real impairment test. So they would say, even though they might know that this asset might be impaired, as long as you have good indicator, they could argue that it hasn't triggered indicator yet. So therefore, I think I'm not fancy to removing annual test.
Sure.
I agree with Steve that I think that the issue we have with value and use is a trust or a perception issue. But I also do agree with Francoise to some extent, because presumably 36 doesn't just say you can make up whatever number you feel like. So I'd be interested what it is that if there's a problem with the standard, what are the words there that are unhelpful or that could be more helpful? And a confirmation that, in fact, if you were to move more to fair value, that really does improve the ability to verify the numbers, because I think we have lots of questions from people about the validity of level 3 fair value measurements as well. So I'd like to understand a little bit more this whole difference in verification and whether it's real or not, and whether we're reacting to a compliance issue as opposed to something that's actually wrong in the standard. But I do agree it's about trust. Then I just had one question about the test that was set out in paragraph 37. The way that I read it when I got to subparagraph C with this revision of key targets, would this not mean that if management kept revising their targets downwards, that it would take longer to trigger an impairment test? Or am I misunderstanding what you meant there? So it says that you would update the key targets each reporting period and then use those as the basis for the impairment indicator in the following period. So does that not mean that if I keep revising downwards what my original expectations were, that it makes it harder to trigger the impairment test, and therefore it wouldn't help with timeliness? No?
The way I'd read that, though, was that if you do revise downward, that in itself would trigger an impairment test in this period. If you then conclude that you're not impaired in this period, then you would roll forward with those new levels. until such time as you revised again.
I'm wondering whether that drip, 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 drip approach, is, if you can in the first instance say, no, it's not so bad that it's an impairment today, but you've then lowered your base next year, does it not make it easier to sort of
to meet
next year? Because now I'm not going back to the start, I'm going to my, I think it might not help with timeliness.
Darryl?
I just wanted to respond a little bit to what Tuck said. I certainly think that if we are focusing on simplicity, cost savings and cost relief and et cetera, then I think an indicator-based approach does make a lot of sense. We use indicator-based approaches elsewhere in IFRS. So I certainly wouldn't want to shut down that approach at this stage. I think it's also very useful that the FASB already has an indicator base. So I think that does give us the opportunity to have a look at what they're doing. So
especially if we combine it with better disclosure.
Absolutely. So I would certainly encourage that we do look at an indicator-based approach. I accept the concerns Tuck's raised, but I think it has merit to at least explore it.
Just a couple of things I would like to add on the FASB's indicator approach. One, it is an optional test. And the other thing is they also have this more likely than not as a condition in the indicator-based approach. So, I mean, we'll bring back more analysis on that in the next meeting.
Yeah, but I agree with Darryl. It's really worthwhile. John Wu?
Thank you. Yeah, on this key performance targets approach, I like this this idea is very good. However, one thing to keep your mind is these targets must be publicly available targets. So external markets should understand these numbers are in public. So it's a kind of a trust issue, as Steve said. If we use these targets as internal numbers, then investors still might have a good doubt about these comparison even. So as much as possible, you should create the kind of targets publicly available.
It depends on the company itself, whether it is a public company. As it also kind of quiet, this goes.
I thought there was going to be a separate discussion about 18D, but that's not the case.
Makes
so
sense. Yeah, I've teed up 18D.
My concern about time has gone. But you still might want to have lunch. Mary?
I just want to join your, I think, Darryl's encouragement to explore the indicators a little further. It had not been clear to me when I read the section that you were seeing the indicators as useful as an alternative for annual testing for only a limited period of time, and that's what I took from your earlier response. So that was helpful. But in exploring this set of indicators and the kind of thinking you have here, I'd like to go back to a point Gary made and ask you to think about what we've learned in the PIR. Is the sense that goodwill goes bad early or later? And if it's early, I think that builds on, if it's later, I think it builds on Gary's comment, which is it's kind of a lot of process, unlikely to identify much impairment because the goodwill in the acquisition is proved successful or unsuccessful in later years rather than earlier years, and that suggests that you can look for a lighter touch, less prescriptive approach in the period immediately after. If, however, what we heard in the PIR in connection with the too little, too late comments is that it's clear very early on, then I think we should not be looking for relief. So can you relate your analysis of using an indicator-only approach, in at least in early periods, to evidence we got about when, you know, an acquisition success or failure is more likely to occur? Because if we're focusing all the guns on the wrong period, then that doesn't seem to make much sense. And the other thing, though, that I think before we start getting into arm wrestling about for how long, you know, what's the duration for which an indicator-based approach would be useful is remembering all the feedback we've heard about how the further you get away from the acquisition date, the harder it is to have, the harder and the more costly it is to have information that's meaningful about the acquisition itself as it gets further integrated and get further away. So presumably anything like what you've described in paragraph 37 is valid only for a relatively short period after the acquisition. So that's another reason why it's only kind of a bridging concept. And so it brings me back to saying, if it's only a bridging concept, is it useful to have a bridging concept, or are the first few years the most critical and the ones in which we should be bringing the most quantitative analysis, or the first few years the lowest risk period, in which case letter touch, and you still have this information, would seem to fit together as a nice package. But it just, it needs anchoring back to the evidence.
I just wanted to address Francoise's concern about fair value not reflecting synergies. It does. Paragraph 31A1 talks about when you're looking at the value of an asset, you assume the market participant has the same access to the other assets that you do. So in other words, synergies are reflected in fair value.
Thank you.
Completely convinced now. That has changed my view.
I give you the floor to change your mind.
I will think thoroughly about it. Now, I just wanted to echo what has been said around this approach, and largely echo what Mary said about being cautious about the feasibility. But I would encourage you to look into this much further. Not only because it could be a relief in the impairment testing eventually, but largely because the message that we received loud and clear from users after the post-implementation review was that they were in demand for having feedback on how the acquisition had benefited compared to the original expectations. I think it's a very high ambition, but I think it's worth looking into because as I said, responds to those needs. And that's, you know, the trust in the impairment testing is very low anyway, so the fact that it is mandatory on a yearly basis doesn't bring any help right now in this area. If they had a better understanding of how things develop, eventually they would regain confidence even in the value in use calculation.
Okay, thank you very much. I think the staff has more than enough to chew on. And that brings us to the end of this.
Sorry, can we talk about the disclosure? Because this is a separate paper, so I was wondering if I can bring it.
If you would like, here.
Yes, thank you. With respect to disclosure, I quite agree that we could enhance the more relevant disclosure. However, we have two challenges. One challenge is the commercial sensitivity information. And actually, the detail of acquisition and the detail of key performance is sometimes very sensitive for the entity to disclose, especially in the environment of the highly competitive industry sectors. So they are looking at, same companies, and merger and acquisition is very, very important issue. So therefore, many companies are quite reluctant to disclose such a key performance issue. That's the first challenge. The second challenge is the compliance. As it is written in your paper, current IAS 36 requires relatively comprehensive disclosures, but we can't get that detailed disclosure. I think because of the commercial sensitivity and others. So therefore, I do agree we need more disclosures. However, just simply raise the requirement wouldn't work anyway. So that is what we need.
That isn't just common practice in takeovers. Companies fork out billions and billions for a takeover that they
tell investors this is what we expect in terms of synergies. And they do give a lot of KPIs already to the market.
Yeah.
I mean, to justify it.
To justify it. But the point is effectiveness. And also, you know, the entity do not really disclose what's the real KPI, what's, you know, real performance which is happening. We can see a lots of cases which company has already disclosed that this is our KPI, we are performing well, saying that for 7 years, but all of a sudden huge impairment after 7 years. What was those KPIs disclosures all about? So that's the issue is of compliance. So therefore, to say that you know you should disclose it would work, but as it is written in your paper, it's going to be a boilerplate, and that is you know what I wanted to say. And the other thing I want to raise is in this project is we are chasing after two hares, and those two hares are running 180 degrees different direction. So therefore, at some stage, we need to decide which hares we are chasing. And say, for example, we think to raise the effectiveness is more important. Then, in that case, we need to sacrifice simplification.
That is possible.
And if that is the case, I think it would be a good idea to introduce some self-policing mechanism is one of the idea. Because once we said we need this disclosure and we need this impairment test, you need these evidences, I don't think it would work, including compliance issue. However, if the acquisition is huge, this is important, but it wouldn't be important for smaller cases. So if we could introduce some self-policing mechanism, like the choice of immediate write-off or short amortization. So if you don't like these disclosures, then you can go to immediate write-off or shorter amortization may work. That is my idea. But in the future, we can discuss such kind of things.
So radical suggestion.
Can I add a very short observation? I think one of the key problems of the current impairment model or business combination is, goodwill in many cases created because of market search. And in this case, it's hard to use indicators or to solve the problems through disclosure.
Gary,
yeah, I also agree we need more disclosures, and I'll just sort of focus on paragraph 31, take in reverse order. Actually, I like the idea of disclosing the acquisition, the goodwill by acquisition as it accumulated. I think that's useful, and I think it's actually should be generally easy to do. The acknowledging Cox's point about sensitivity of management budgeting and stuff, I still think some combination of B or C, just how is the acquisition doing, whether it's just absolute dollars or, it delivered this much of profit or this much of revenue, or maybe it's against performance targets, but what if the acquisition pricing said we're assuming long-term 10% growth in profits? Well, there can be a lot of overs and unders that still average out to 10% over the long term. So you don't always get your performance expectations packaged and communicated in annual report type terms. So I think it has to be something of a principle or more of an objectives-based approach, some quantitative communication about how is the acquisition doing. I don't know that we can be prescriptive. I don't think that it's, but objectives is a little bit more precise than principles. For reasons that I don't remember why we made it in the March meeting, I actually happen to like having payback disclosed. We voted against it, but it we're looking to simplify things. Payback is one of the more simple, you know, calculations that you find in the economics textbooks. And as we voted against it, I'm just expressing I think we should do it. And I think I actually don't think 31A about reasons for the prepayment is just, I think, just going to get you a boilerplate. I don't think it's going to add a whole lot. And if it's the premium as opposed to the reasons for the total purchase price, you might get different answers. The total purchase price is sort of the cash out the door, the fair value of the shares that you distributed, and say, you know, you could say we expect it to deliver ROI or ROA consistent industry norms in the 8-10% range or something. I think if you start saying the premium, the first thing you're going to get boilerplate would be, the problem is not what I paid for the company. I've got fairness opinions and it's how markets have been done. The problem is the accounting that doesn't know how to subdivide goodwill into the workforce and all the synergies. I think that's what you're going to get. So I don't think 31A, as written, you know, the reasons for the payment of the premium is going to get you very much.
I was just thinking, a lot of acquisitions are motivated by increasing the pricing power of the company. Will a company disclose that they will be able to charge more to their customers?
Probably not.
Okay,